We talked a while ago about this business of Protestantism, science, and capitalism, right? And we said, I think the one important thing we said there was that for a long time people have wondered about these three things all sort of going on at once, roughly, and get involved in discussions about, well, what really is Protestantism, and, well, what really is capitalism, understanding needs to be historically created. But science, no problem, it's trans-historic. And when we talked about that, I said, look, you got to remember science gets created too. All right, having reminded you about that, remember what Ben David says. You can say all you want about the Weber thesis or Tommy's version of it, and there's a lot to say there. I mean, just read those excerpts from Luther, and you got to be pretty dense not to see something like a work ethic in there, right? Sundays only, get rid of all these saints' days, stop goofing around, these idle rich like the Fugger bankers, oops, I thought they were capitalists. And there's a kind of rural, there's a sort of rusticity to Luther. These guys that just sit around collecting interest strike him also as idle people. So he's a little confused about the nature of finance capital, but that's all right, what do you expect? I mean, it's hard even to read Luther not to see this kind of industriousness business going on. So it's tempting to say, well, look, science is all about industriousness, modern science. It's all about what the Royal Society says it's about. The production of useful knowledge. It looks very much like a marriage of craft, traditions, and rational theory, mathematics, and so on. Galileo embodies that sort of thing. And there must be some kind of connection between some kind of Protestant ethic and the new science. And perhaps there is. Which people talk about a lot. I mean, if you wanted to investigate this, you'd have to read through. There's three or four good articles a year discussing this, Puritanism and science in England, and so on and so forth. Ben David rather cleverly notices that this can't be that true, because just ask yourself, how's science doing where Protestantism gets its way? And so you ask, well, how's science doing in Salem, Massachusetts? Right? How's science doing up on the Baltic? How's science doing in Calvin's Geneva? Not so great. It's going on, and later in the 17th century, which I suppose becomes a Geneva that's rather less Calvinist, if that's possible. Science is doing okay, if you think that Descartes is a good example of science. The Academy of Sciences of Geneva decides to sort of become Cartesian advocates. But science is really booming along, if to use those terms, Ben David says, exactly in those places where a Protestant challenge to existing authority is strong enough to loosen that kind of command and control it has over people's activities, but the challenge is not strong enough to win the day. In other words, Ben David thinks, and I think there's a lot to this, that science really isn't, because this strengthens his thesis too, science is really in business where, to put it roughly, the social and political fabric is shook up enough that these new activities can slot in there and form up and establish themselves. So England's a pretty good candidate for this, because I might be wrong about this, but of all the places that suffered Reformation, I think a place where the state churches, the Anglican church, would be that which has moved less far away from Catholic doctrine than anywhere else you can imagine. But it's important that it no longer well, I was going to say no longer needs to pay attention to the Pope. It would be better to say now understands the Pope to be its mortal foe. This does produce a kind of independence for the state, for the crown. But it would be kind of hard to say that Protestantism is in charge.
There's also sort of the idea that in Britain, the drive, the force behind the Reformation was more of, just to use a sort of cliche, Henry VIII's desire to do his own thing rather than, it was fueled by a political discontent more than a theological revolution.
That's probably true everywhere. As a formula. I mean, the way to look at this would be just look across the map of continental Europe, at least the Germanies where Luther's talking. I mean, we have hundreds of sovereign states. You know, the city of Nuremberg is a sovereign state. There is no state of Germany, not for 200, 300 years. If you look in each of those places, especially after the settlement, isn't it the Peace of Augsburg that says you're whoever is the king or prince, that's what religion you are? 1540, I forget the date, 85 or something. And there's a tremendous civil war about this. One thing when you're reading Hobbes, you have to realize that when Hobbes is writing, Europe has been engaged in a civil war of 150 years duration. I mean, if you think of Europe as Christendom, it's one of those horrendous civil wars, writ large. I think of England and Ireland, and then spread this over all of Europe. And yes, superficially you might say it's a religious argument, but it plainly isn't that within 1 inch of the surface. So if you were to survey these places and say that what's really going on is who's going to be in charge, it would seem to me the most powerful rival of a Catholic prince might find it very tempting to become a sincere Protestant and see if that won't help. And I think that happens in lots of cases. And Henry VIII is a perhaps an extraordinary person, but quite a rather ordinary prince in those days, in the sense of just like the kings and queens of France, wanting to consolidate power in the crown. And we were talking about inflation, and he's got this whole problem of national Department of Finance. He's got to buy navies and so on. If you're on fixed income, this is tough, so it might be nice to confiscate land from somebody who's got a lot of land, those papists. So you decide you can't stand your wife, you see. It gets intricate. Anyway, why are we talking about this? What's Galileo on about? Well, let's come back to Earth. Or back to Galileo, anyway. Did you want to put out?
Just answering to Dan's question earlier, where you were saying,
Why does he risk it?
Why would he risk it? And I would agree with him.
Yeah.
He was risking. He wasn't risking it so much as he was. He stepped back when he nailed him before, and nothing happened to him. He looked around a bit and decided he might as well try it again. He seemed to be immune. I thought that was Westfall's argument.
Yeah.
He stepped forward.
That was Westfall's argument, I think, that it was a big gamble, but he decided he could come out unscathed. That's Westfall's argument. So, I guess we have a choice. He could have just made a mistake in judgment. He certainly didn't intend to take on something that would beat him or grind him down. but he gambled and lost. The thing I find difficult about Westphal's argument, though I'm sure if I were to point this out, he would easily, I mean, it's not something that causes anyone to reject it. It seems to me he's making too much of a distinction between this business of patronage and this business of, in fact, the substance of belief or the intellectual substance of the discussion. The Jesuits are not simply threatened by somebody who's not a Jesuit that might be more powerful than the best of them, it seems to me. It's not just that their status somehow collectively, I mean, it may be it's the status business is a kind of zero-sum game, and there's only enough status to go around, and if Galileo gets more, we have to have less. That may well be true, and in that sense, the Jesuits are threatened so long as Galileo is triumphant. But I don't think that's enough. I mean, maybe we could imagine them trying to make him one of their own, but that's a little hard to do. It's hard to imagine Galileo having a conversion experience for any reason at all and become a Jesuit. So sure, there is this business of the Jesuits being threatened in that sheer sense of status, but I can't believe that's all there is to it.
Isn't it more the overall impact it's going to have on them? I let them the fact that Joan Moss.
Yeah,
he seems to point out the fact that the, you know, maybe taking into account a reinterpretation of the scriptures and.
Yeah. Well, that's not a problem, necessarily. Yeah, go ahead.
And Westphal, I think, even alludes to it,
mm-hmm.
that the central issue isn't necessarily the patrons thing for the Jesuits, but the Galileo, he might be missing, he might think that's what's motivating the Jesuits, and that might be the problem. That's why he underestimates them, because he's playing that game to them, and he's looking at it that way. The Jesuits, instead of looking down the road and saying, wait, if this is true and that's true, then we're going to be in big trouble if he steps down the road. We've got to slow this guy down a bit.
Okay, so you're suggesting, this might be right, something like this. You're suggesting that maybe it's right. Galileo just can't see anything wrong with his vision of how to redistribute authority between science and theology. That's what the letter to Christina is about, a kind of net redistribution of authority. We should talk about just how. And that he just can't see what's wrong with it. And furthermore, on this Copernicus business, his position is pretty steadfastly, and I think Westphal's right about this, not that I've got to, you know, whatever I do, you guys all have to be convinced that Copernicus is right, or suffer abuse, but as a loyal son of the church that wishes to appear to be, and quite probably is, the church should not place itself in the position of making a horribly embarrassing error, that is, condemning something as false which might turn out to be true. And this is what he wishes them to avoid. So don't take a position on this. Leave it open. So he may see so clearly that that's the right way to go, that if he's being opposed, it can only be on the grounds of power, status, prestige, or some other kind of, finally, at the end of the day, bad reason. It's just somebody scared of their job. Who needs it? This is much too important to worry about niceties like that. And that he doesn't see what at least Bellarmine and quite apparently a whole bunch of other Jesuits and beyond can see, that what he's talking about is a lot more threatening in their eyes than just a bunch of jobs. That what he's talking about is subversive of an entire political order. And that it's not just that he's a closet Copernican, he's gravely in danger without knowing it. That's part of his problem of being a closet Lutheran. And he doesn't even know that. So that might be what happens. That might be the problem. That he literally doesn't know what he's doing on that front.
Yeah. He seems pretty aware that he's constructed a new world system in the very title of that.
Oh yeah, but wait a minute. That's the language referred to. I mean, that's almost technical talk for cosmology. It doesn't have to imply anything about new political order, new social order,
or any meaning like that.
No, well, I don't think
but
so.
There is these things, like for instance, here yeah. when Castelli yeah. writes to him and he says, "Thereupon, after having made suitable disclaimers, I commenced to play the theologian with such assurance and dignity that it would have done you good to hear me."
Yeah.
That sounds very tongue-in-cheek, as though we're just amusing these people, telling them things they want to hear,
yeah.
so that they won't feel too upset by the things we have to say. But we don't really care, I mean, whether or not Galileo believed or not, was a believer or not, that seems to him a completely separate issue. He's more interested in how his cannonballs fly and things like that. This is the impact that I get from this kind of thing. So while what I said was that Galileo needn't have challenged the system the way he did in order to have convinced the people, but in fact he was already in his own mind of a completely different way of thinking from these people. It's that, although he, you know, like in the passage, the letter to Christina, it does sound slightly disingenuous. Like, you don't have to get scared by this stuff. You know, let us do our stuff, we can do yours.
Well, it's pretty plain to me that there is, that Galileo does pass that, I called it moment, when he decides that Aristotelianism is just bankrupt. In fact, it's worse than bankrupt, it's a pathology. And the people who believe in it are necessarily engaging in superstition, in the traditional sense of the word, being kind of hypnotized by ghosts and fairies and so on. The telling place for me, and I think the telling passage where this is revealed for me is in the dialogues on the two world systems. And while I'm telling you this and reminding you where you read it, what you read, ask yourself, does Galileo believe this or is it rhetoric? Okay? As if that were an either-or thing. Simplicio has, let's see, what's happened? Simplicio has made another of his stupid speeches about perfection and imperfection, corruptibility, incorruptibility. And Salviati almost cuts him off with a kind of impatient, you know, waving of the hands and dismissal, saying, the only reason I can think that you go on and on about corruptibility and incorruptibility is the fear you have of your own mortality, the fear you have of death. And now, just can you imagine a more humiliating and sarcastic remark than the one that follows? What you deserve is to be turned into statues of jade so you will become more perfect than you are. Oh, I mean. Now, what's he saying there? What he's saying, it seems to me, as I read it, and then you tell me rhetoric or not, he's essentially saying this Aristotelian stuff, this teleology about human perfection and the perfection of cats and rocks and stellar substances and so on, this is all a crutch for frightened children. this is the kind of stuff that people believe who need comforting illusions. This is the kind of stuff for the fairy tales and the babies. That's what it is. It's a comforting illusion for disabled people. And disabled people flock to it. And there they are. Just look at all the Aristotelians. It's a pathology. Or it's being spouting Aristotelianism is a symptom of a disease. It's a kind of immaturity. And Galileo stands for this heroic self who knows the need to resist comforting illusions in the name of maturity, adulthood, or self-respect, and chooses to face stern and harsh realities. And that's what the new man is like, right? And that's who he stands for. So, I mean, nothing seems to me to get across more clearly and dramatically what's going on when he's putting down these Aristotelians. I mean, it's to say they're object of contempt is much too weak. They are, and there's a kind of mixture of, I mean, think now, just psychologically, do a little Hobbes on yourself. What do you really feel like when you're faced with someone who is in some sense, I don't mean just literally, disabled? Especially if it's not kind of thing, but obviously it's just generates sympathy and concern, but the kind of disablement that's annoying, kind of cloyingly dependent person. You know, I mean, you feel, you know as well as I do, you feel a kind of combination of pity and anger. You just want to squash them. You want them to go away, get out of your sight, and stop reminding you of how much they need. You know, I mean, it's that kind of passion that's getting aroused. Now, it seems to me Galileo's involved in that to some extent. Now, I'm overdoing it. Obviously, but when he, let's just put it another way. When you think it's appropriate, and here I'm kind of answering the question, either as rhetoric or as sincere belief, when you think it's appropriate to explain the beliefs of another by reference to their psychology, you are announcing that you can't understand how a reasonable, self-respecting human being could believe that junk. Right? We need an account. We need an explanation. Right? Why these people are adhering to this stuff. And the fact that in the dialogue, Galileo, on several occasions, but most dramatically on that occasion, says that in order to understand why there are any Aristotelians at all, you need to do psychology. You know, I mean, it's pretty plain what the status of that system of thought is in his mind. And so that piece of text is also, at least in my line of argument, some evidence for what I imagine is that dramatic moment when Galileo decides and realizes that he can't be an Aristotelian. So,
would it not have been I think it's probably mentioned, a cultural clash with Galileo rising in stature from another community, one that builds and does and makes, who are used to having their profession scorned by the people at the university as being lowly craftsmen, and now their star is rising, and so like the nouveau riche, they need the justification for why they, you know, their schemes.
Well, I'm not inclined to make too much of that. The Galileo family is an old Florentine family. It has not been as fortunate of late as it was before. But Galileo has standing, Plato has standing. It's not high standing, but on the other hand, neither is he arrested of such sort. And there are plenty of examples of people of humble origins. In fact, I mean, in a way, it might almost count against the argument. The major institution for raising up lowly people is the Roman Church. Bellarmine is not born into a family of much status, and he has a tremendous standing in the Church. And in one sense, before modern science, I mean, here's another one of these contrasts. Before modern science, it's the Roman Church that is the biggest agent of social mobility ever known. It takes all of these people out of lowly situations. Some of them become very... So I'm not sure that's so much of a problem, except for the way in which Galileo makes it pretty clear that he does represent what he's speaking for. I mean, assuming he writes everything he writes on purpose and does deliberate it, he can't just be, well, it's not just offhand that he opens the discorsi with a remark about how much he learns by hanging around the Venetian arsenal, amongst people, some of whom are even unlettered, and that this speaks volumes compared to what we would find hanging around the University of Pisa. I mean, he's saying that quite on purpose. I don't think what it means is lost on anybody. So there might be something to that. And the business of being cut down to size that Westfall refers to, that's relevant. But I guess what I've been addressing kind of obliquely and circling around is the business of the intellectual content of his challenge, which it seems to me is pretty real. And it's basically, I mean, Westfall's right in place to talk about it. Roughly speaking, you might say the argument is about patronage in one sense, in the sense of who's going to be in charge of the educational system. The Jesuits, collective as they are, with processes in place for speaking with one mind, or something else that we've not yet seen yet, but is announced by Galileo as something involving, I'll put it crudely, I can't think of a better word, but roughly speaking, involving Galileo and his friends, some of whom might be Jesuits or Benedictines. One thing the Jesuits know is that they are in charge of the educational system. They are being challenged on a daily basis by Dominicans and Benedictines and others. And now along comes Galileo, in a position to make alliances with we're not sure who. Probably not the Dominicans, because they look rather like the right wing version. The Jesuits think of themselves as liberal progressive, I guess. And where's Galileo in all this? Pretty radical, perhaps. And what does it look like if Galileo's in charge of the education system? So there's how you can sort of slide from patronage to power, status, and its substantial consequences. And let me just put it very simply, it seems to me, and then you can tell each other and me what you think of this, it seems to me that Galileo as much as announces that he would prefer a Lutheran education system. And here's where you find him. Now, I'm overdoing it. He never says that. But who's, in the letter to Christina, who's Galileo's favorite theologian? Augustine. Is he aware who else has said, my favorite saint is Augustine? Luther. Is he aware of this? Is he aware of the 18 years of the Council of Trent talking about how Augustine maybe ought to be relegated to a somewhat lower status, especially since Augustine seems to have been crucially important in supporting Luther's doctrines. Is Galileo aware of this? Or is he really blithely saying, listen, you got no problem with me because I got Augustine on my side? And isn't he aware what he's saying when he says that? Or the thing I mentioned the time before last, another bit of, is it rhetoric or sincere belief in the dialogue where he makes this remark another place where he's fed up with Simplicio. But remember, it's a constructed fed upness because he's writing all those parts. You have to remember the dialogue is not the Borghese garden tapes or something. These are not transcripts of any conversations. Galileo is writing a dialogue. Whatever Simplicio says, Galileo is the author of it. He's the author of the whole damn thing. It's all constructed by him. So you got to remember that. So nothing happens that he doesn't intend. However much sometimes, as it does happen with authors, things sort of take on a life of their own and the thing begins to come alive. But anyway, here's another one of those moments where Galileo arranges for Salviati to be fed up with Simplicio, and we get this business of essentially, I've really had it with you bozos. You treat natural science as if it were some kind of debating society, as if we were talking about some proposition in law or in the humanities, where, he says, as everybody knows, there is no such thing as true or false, there is only opinion. And since there is only opinion in law and the humanities, of course, the person with the readiest mouth, with the best rhetoric, is going to win the day. But nature doesn't care about that. Nature is indifferent to all of this posture. Nature doesn't care a whit what you or I think. Nature is the way it is, and it's the truths of nature we're talking about. And the implication of all of this is there's this activity called reading the book of nature, which I, Galileo, show you how to do, and it's the only place there's truth or falsity. Except maybe for reading scripture, where there's also truth or falsity. But all this business of law and the humanities, and that is the right term. I mean, the Italian is humanitas. He's talking about what we call the humanities and law, lego. But it seems to me, and this is just a conjecture, I'd have to know a lot more about the context of law, but my conjecture is an educated person, take Bellarmine, reading that passage says, this man is crazy. He's saying that in ethics, moral philosophy, politics, and law, there's no such thing as what's true. There's just opinion. All of this stuff, all of natural law theory is just a bunch of opinion. Galileo is implying here, if you ask the question, what is justice? The right answer is the one given by Thrasymachus. Justice is what the strong want. That seems to be the implication here. So why couldn't we imagine, I mean, if we're going to credit people with insight and intelligence, Galileo understanding himself perhaps to be representative of a new order, why can't we also imagine that someone with the intelligence of Bellarmine, whose intelligence I find sometimes almost Canadian, why not imagine that Bellarmine can see, lurking as it were, lurking is the right word, Bellarmine can see in Galileo's propositions not the kind of ameliorative, friendly Christian society for useful knowledge, such as might be promoted by Francis Bacon, who's very careful every now and then to tell you that all these activities are to be governed by Christian charity, but rather the relentless Leviathan of Hobbes. Why can't Bellarmine see that sitting there in the new science of Galileo? A theory of politics that says men are beasts, and what political theory is all about is how shall these beasts tame themselves since they have nothing else to go on but their own self-interest, not to be killed. And that's the beginning and the end of political theory. In other words, why not imagine somebody like Bellarmine can see Galileo as, how should I put it, involving himself, half without knowing it, in what Leo Strauss would call a nihilist theory of politics. In other words, what I'm constructing around all this is what seems to me, I'm suggesting grounds for finding Galileo absolutely scary.
Where's Matthew?
I'm not sure. Oh, Machiavelli's in the 1420s. So he's long ago. 1520s, what was it? 1520s. Machiavelli's a great Florentine and a great believer in civic virtue and republicanism, and also in understanding some things about the world and power. So I have Machiavelli's. Again, it's the anti-Catholics who specialize in being frightened by Machiavelli. We're running out of time.
It's sort of interesting to look at it, you know, sort of the opposite direction, sort of see why would the Jesuits be so determined to get Galileo.
He's a dangerous man,
yeah,
that's why.
Because, you know, it's sort of a getting back to the question of authority,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, Galileo sort of is arguing that there should be a separation between science and faith, because if you look at, you know, things that were written about his trial where he was condemned, he's always arguing, I'm not denying the scriptures, and I'm not, you know, I'm arguing science is one thing and faith is another. And the Jesuits, you know, a theological society dedicated to education, have this sort of, they seem almost this paranoia that if they are proven to be wrong in their science, this is going to be reflect that they must be wrong in their theology as well.
Well, it's not just if you can't tie your shoes, maybe you can't ride a bike. It's they are teaching natural law theory. Now, it's not 13th century natural law theory, it's state-of-the-art natural law theory, but they think, like Aquinas, that ethics is a science. Theology is a science. These are all sciences and objects of human knowledge. Here's Galileo. I mean, I should have said this because it would have made it much clearer. Galileo's position on science and religion in the letter to Christina sounds just like Luther. Look, there's all this stuff between you and God, call it scripture and faith. And yes, there are all these people that run around and read scripture, fine. There's another thing called science. These have nothing to do with each other. Augustine's hold out to support the proposition that knowledge of nature has got nothing to do with salvation. Well, now try to, remembering the story we sort of painfully constructed from Aristotle to Aquinas, and vaguely beyond, a trajectory that's meant to kind of land us in Bellarmine's study, say to Bellarmine, knowledge of nature has got nothing to do with salvation. And I think his reply would be, if you believe that, I can't imagine you passed third grade. What are you doing? What are you talking about? Do you see what I mean? What is this vision of things you have in which knowledge of the nature of things has got nothing to do with salvation? Bellarmine is the author of a wonderful book, but listen to what it's titled. Listen to what this title says. It's a spiritual book, and it's entitled The Mind's Ascent to God Through the Ladder of Created Things. He's essentially telling you, study biology and you will come closer to God. And he means it. He starts with dirt, water, and goes right through all the creatures. And this is the mind's ascent to God through the ladder of created things. Say to Bellarmine, knowledge of nature has got nothing to do with salvation. I mean, you're really messing around. And so, I mean, given knowing that, here's Bellarmine's advice to Galileo, which almost reads like, here's between the lines. I will act as if I didn't hear what you said. And perhaps you will be subtle enough to notice that those things you say best go unnoticed and undiscussed. Maybe you'll get the hint. I trust I didn't hear you. Right?
But Galileo's defense during his trial was that Bellarmine had given him a letter.
Which,
you know, gave him specific restrictions which he had adhered to. And the idea that the prosecution, so to speak, the imposition, had to drag out this one questionable authenticity, which of course they didn't have to show, is sort of a measure of how desperate they were to shut him up.
Okay.
How much what desperate measures they went to muzzle him because he was perceived as such a threat.
Well, yeah. All right. Look, we really should quit because it's time. You say what you want to say because I didn't let you, and then I'll say something.
The big thing that they seem to think Bowery and all the other ones seem to think the whole established train of thought is that theology is sort of the master science, and all the other ones have to defer to theology. And Galileo's coming along and saying, well, that's not right. And that's shaking them up a lot.
Well, remember Tolisani about Copernicus. And remember that I tried to show you that although it sounded awfully authoritarian, if the issue were about legitimacy of authority, you'd agree with it. Here again, we have this question about authority. And Galileo's position on theology and science just sounds awfully Lutheran. And I guess what I'm saying, partly as a way of looking ahead, that road leads to Hobbes. And that might be one way of your seeing what Bellarmine might understand. Now, we haven't talked about Hobbes explicitly yet, and I don't think Hobbes is such a nasty fellow. I think he's quite wonderful, in fact. But when you see what he's saying, you can see why this might shake people up a bit. Anyway, look. Next time we should talk about Bacon and Hobbes and Boyle and so on, we'll lead into it by talking a little bit more about Galileo. What we should do is get clear, so we understand it, the circumstances that provoke the trial. And I think what we'll learn about that, really, is that it is a situation, the publication of the dialogue just makes it impossible to ignore him. And certain circumstances about it make it impossible he's going to be ignored. Roughly speaking, as Westfall implied, he either inadvertently or with malice of intent goes quite out of the way to offend the Pope, Maffeo Barberini of the Barberini family, who was a student of his and with whom he discussed the writing of this dialogue. I'll tell you right now so you can think about it. This takes 20 seconds. The Pope suggested Maffeo, who became Pope in 1623, I think, 24. Galileo rushes to Rome, at last, a humanist Pope. wonderful, terrific. And Galileo rushes to Rome to talk to his pal, Maffeo, who is now Urban VIII, about all his plans, including a dialogue on the efflux and regress of the sea. And it's going to be about